The next witness is Mr. John Sachs Fernandez from the National University of Mexico, and who is in charge of the World Today program of the Center for Interdisciplinary Research. I give him the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate very much this invitation. It's an event which makes our lives more significant. It's the type of activity which I consider important while we are on the surface of the planet. I'm trying to give a context of how sociologists and political scientists have seen this trend towards conservatism in the United States and analyzed it. So just to contextualize this problem, this phenomenon. On September 15 of 2002, a year after the attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the Sunday Herald carried an article that called our attention on the existence of a plan drawn up by a neoconservative institute, and the term is used in the press release, identified as the Project for a New American Century, which started work in 1997. The institute, as you have heard, is oriented to boost what is found in document is qualified as a Reaganian policy of military strength and moral clarity, consider something necessary for the United States based on the success of last century, they point out, to consolidate our safety and our greatness for the next century. The document is very militaristic in its view and quite imperialistic, raising the strengthening of Pax Americana on a global scale. It was endorsed, as you also heard from the previous witness, by people like Dick Cheney, Ronald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Jeff Bush, Louis Lobby, which is the chief of staff of Cheney, with the participation of political operators, ideologists such as Francis Fukuyama and others. The Herald emphasized that in keeping with the document agenda, before Bush assumed the presidency, he and his group were already contemplating and planning a regime change in Iraq, which would be achieved by a premeditated attack against that country. The main proposal of the document, whose principal author is Thomas Donnelly, is that nowadays the United States doesn't have a global rival, and its overall strategy must be designed to preserve and spread out that advantageous position in the future as much as it could be possible. The military tool is considered, as happened during the Reagan era, the foundation in the defense of the interests of the United States, the ability to wage several wars at the same time, as well as the development of military and paramilitary capabilities, quote, to influence in a decisive way the foreign policy of the United States. Finally, it proposes to change the armed forces to take advantage of the new revolution in military affairs. For this to happen, the United States, among other things, must keep its superiority in nuclear strategy and not restrict itself in the balance of power with Russia. The proposal carries with it, to the approval of the military-industrial complex people, enlargements in the military budget for the maintenance and extension of United States supremacy, basically in terms of military strength. The events of September 11 were suited to a T to promote this proposal, which involved a deepening and toughening of militaristic and right-wing stances and related programs, which were present during the Clinton administration, in which, with nationalistic imperial arrogance, the United States was considered the indispensable nation. Bush made this more acute and took this perspective further, paradoxically raising doubts about the whole multilateral structure and the alliance system of the Pax Americana that came out after World War II. It's very important to take note that during the 8 months prior to 9/11, the Bush administration seems to either not have taken very seriously terrorist threats within the United States, or still were made a systematic effort at underfunding and understaffing all internal counter-terrorist programs, while at the same time withdrawing unilaterally from the Treaty for the Global Traffic Control of Arms Small Caliber Weapons, the Kyoto Agreement, the Treaty to Remove Landmines, the Convention on Biological Weapons and Toxins, and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, whilst also being against and sabotaging in a very proactive way the establishment and construction of the International Criminal Court. Also, they were to cause deeper transatlantic frictions. It's a program which is very Reaganian program, which means it's a very Keynesian, military Keynesian, economically Keynesian program. And therefore, it keeps with some of these features. It has deepened transatlantic frictions with stances related to trade, steel in protectionist policies, compensations for agriculture, high-tech, increases in the military presence in several countries, restoring alliances and bases without considering, as it happened during the Reagan time, the issues of human rights, because according to these people, at that time and nowadays, many of the Bush cabinet above these human rights are the vital interests and the necessities of a global war against terrorism, taken as a central organizing principle after September 11. Raising the subjects and their concretion in decisions like the ones that I have exemplified, you have a group of hardline ideologists, including journalists, academicians such as William Bristol, Robert Kagan, founder members of the project, David Frum, who invented the term X-axis of evil, Richard Perle, extreme right-wing ideologist, well known in the Reagan government as the Prince of Darkness, who, joining the staff of the White House, strongly condemned the multilateralist bent of the members of the European Union. For years, there are other people, not necessarily members of the project. They have been elaborating justifications to break out an attack on multilateralism, reaffirm United States unilateralism, like, for example, John Bolton, member of extreme right and anti-Mexican staff, then headed by Senator Jesse Helms, nowadays have been very much involved in the Bush policy towards the United Nations. He holds that, in fact, such an organization, in his opinion, there is an international community that must be ruled by the only world power left. That international community, says Bolton, only works when it is for the United States interests and when we can, he says, get other countries to follow our line. Robert Kaplan, another of the journalists and writers who identifies with the White House perspective, bring up a very interesting subject in the Atlantic Monthly of December of last year, a kind of recipe book to keep a stealth supremacy by means of strengthening paramilitarism, clandestine operations, and restoring the assassination and counterinsurgency programs. For example, he thinks that it would be necessary to use local forces on the United States military coordination through advisors in Arauca, Colombia, which is a very important area because of its hydrocarbon resources. This is no surprise. McNamara, proposed the same use of local forces in Kennedy's and Johnson years. Kaplan thinks that now diplomacy should be carried out by military means, developing strong ties with the local military and strengthening relationships between the United States and those countries through the sale of weapons and the transfer of military training, and also the penetration of military intelligence units in those countries. Kaplan proposes the use of military forces to promote democracy, to increase the display of military bases in order to control natural resources, and a return to former programs such as selective assassination. See, he's very excited about the promise of tech development in these fields, and informs us that, and this is very public, everything is very public, informs us that in the next decade, it will be possible using satellites to track a person's neurobiological signatures, making assassinations more feasible, allowing the United States to kill leaders such as Hussein. There is also, all this is sometimes wrapped in a sense of moral superiority that is somehow linked to illegal operations such as clandestine operations, violations of human rights, massacres of civilians, as it's happening in Iraq. This is set in a deep-seated conviction of Bush and his cabinet, and this cultural setup, very much rooted in the political history of the United States as well, that God is in our side. James Harden, a journalist of the Financial Times, ironically said recently, and I quote him, "With Bush in the White House, God is placed stronger than ever in the heart of the American political project." Well, God has always been there, but not to this extent. Analyst Mariano Aguirre from the Institute of Peace Research in Madrid pointed out that indeed the president's staff is being guided by principles that range from geopolitics and a fundamentalist reading of religion, and remembers that the right-wing Christian Church of the United States and TV evangelists such as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, who have millions of followers, supported both Bush in his crusade against Saddam Hussein and applauded Sharon's brutal attacks against the Palestinians, developing at the same time a strong campaign against the Muslim community of the United States. It's important to remember that these fundamentalists are the vanguard of the fight which end up with the liberties won in the last 30 years in areas such as single mothers, the use of science in the public educational system, free sexual choice. It's worth remembering that after September 11, Falwell, one TV preacher, was sure that the attacks on the World Trade Center and in Washington were God's punishment for the sins of the United States. And Pat Robertson accused, and I quote him, "pagans, women who had had abortions, feminists, gays, lesbians, and the American Civil Liberty Union." And he says, "I point my finger at you and say, thou help to make this happen." These and other crude remarks and the national and international positions that distinguish the neoconservatism of Bush and his staff did not appear by chance. We should remember the historical background as well as the political and ideological components of this phenomenon. Though the rise of power by right-wing forces, commonly known as in the literature the new right, la nueva derecha, came about during the Reagan administration, it's not a recent arrival in the United States political scene. analysts, sociologists, journalists, commentators realized this rising long before Reagan or Bush came to the White House. With Reagan and Bush Senior, a significant amount of people identified with the most reactionary political currents were appointed to high positions in power. In view of this, what was previously a phenomenon usually perceived with scorn by mainstream sociologists and political scientists started to be considered in a more serious and systematic way. That is, the linking of several extreme right groups that were firmly and tenaciously supported economically by big enterprises located in strategic sector like the gas and oil industry. This also included the petrochemical industry, as some of these groups were funded by the DuPont Group of Delaware and companies closely linked to the industrial complex. Among the right-wing groups supported by this corporate machinery, we must mention the John Birch Society, a pressure group headed by Robert Welch, a phenomenon that was minimized by those political science and sociology analysts because it was considered a marginal fringe of the United States political spectrum. It was difficult, after all, to take him seriously. He was someone who maintained that liberals were part of a big communist conspiracy to end freedoms of the United States. And he said, the whole country is a big madhouse, and we have allowed some of the worst patients to run this place, end quote. That is one of his favorite warnings, and that warning was taken over by the Financial Times and applied to the Bush administration. The new American right has been mainly anti-political in the sense that it has never recognized the legitimacy of its opponents nor accepted the rules of the game. This crude anti-political conception of the neoconservatives, which now has specific ideological shades with the Bush administration that I can not go into right now, contrasts with historical American conservatism. Traditional conservatism has been analyzed by historians and sociologists from the United States. They conceive it as the first political movement directly involved in politics. In a study published by a prominent American sociologist in 1977, he raised the point that one of the most important aspects of what he called the classical modern conservatism, that is the conservatism from the 18th and 19th century, was that it was the result of the political decisions of those who were directly involved in the building and the destruction of nations. An important group of scholars contrasts this new right with classical modern conservatism, which rose from the political action of paradigmatic such as Alexander Hamilton and John Adams. But this is not a phenomenon which appears because it is an ideological movement with a preconceived plan to change the world. But it is more the result, this conservative of the 18th and 19th century, an effort to keep the statu quo intact. Classical modern conservatism was mainly preoccupied about the maintenance of the status quo because the men identified as conservatives were men in power, anxious about social and political unrest that could shatter their position in the power structure. In the United States, but we have the new right, the anti-politic tendency of the neoconservatives, which was expressed in a very paradigmatic way by Welch. He puts it this way in a speech he made to a group at that time without they reached positions of power. Gentlemen, we are living in a moment in which the only certain political victories could be achieved by non-political organizations that have a more secure, positive, and permanent proposal. We must work with organizations which have roots, cohesion, clear power and stable leadership, which are impossible to find in the traditional mechanisms of political parties, end quote. Virtually until the election of Reagan, the new right in the United States has acted outside of the system. Its political views and the idea that the country is invaded by the enemy has led them to underestimate political organizations and procedures, and has even served them until very recently as a leitmotif for the creation, training, and technical support of paramilitary and indeed terrorist teams. With what is radical about this group, as well as others, but this is pointed out by sociologist Edward Shields, is not its opposition to domestic or international social aid programs, the payment of taxes, or that evolutionary theory be taught in school, but the hostility towards the political system's framed and its enormous predisposition to put aside the established order. Daniel Bell, another sociologist, put it this way: it would not represent a major trauma, he says, for this kind of right to break up with the constitutional process, suspend civil liberties in its fight against communism. It is in this sense in which the right, more than any other ideology, is a threat to American political civility. But, as I have pointed out, much of the thought of the new right is central of the cultural inheritance of the United States, as well as of the tendencies and ideological campaigns that in different ways have been promoted and used by big enterprises to achieve their goals and to increase and preserve their power. The United States as a social system is no exception in regard to this issue. In the United States, reactionary processes have always anteceded reactionary ideas. When Reagan, for example, proposed the Strategic Defense Initiative as a costly anti-ballistic shield, both the scientific community and the Democrats showed their skepticism and rejection. In the governments of Reagan and Bush Sr., the SDI, Strategic Defense Initiatives, was seen as a project sponsored by Republican hawks. After assuming the presidency, Clinton cut the funding of various programs of SDI, though the Democrat continued supporting different projects of research and development of the system with billions of dollars. And as Nicholas Guyet remembers, finally, in 1999, the Clinton administration bowed to Republican pressure and promised to build a national anti-ballistic system as soon as possible. The Democrats, who previously had condemned Star Wars as a momentary Reagan administration excess, adopted the project as their. This way, since the arrival to power of the new right with Reagan by means of the Republican Party, central parts of the neoconservatives' agenda, like the national anti-ballistic system, a growing unilateralism, and militarization of diplomacy and the withdrawal from multilateral schemes, have entered gradually but constantly in what is known as the mainstream of American politics. During the Cold War, the quality of the national character was strongly influenced by a sense of vulnerability. It's something important because a remarkable transformation anthropologically has taken place in the United States. And back in the Cold War, anthropologist Jules Henry perceived it this way. He said, during the Second World War, Japan was our enemy, now it is our friend. The USSR was our friend, now it's our enemy. Germany was our enemy, now part of it is our friend, part of it is our enemy. France was our friend, now it's almost an enemy. Yugoslavia was a friend, now one day is a friend, the next one is an enemy, depending on the turnabouts of foreign policy. During the Second War, China was a friend, now is an enemy. Italy was an enemy, now is a friend, and so on. So that these strong shifts in the definition of who's the friend and who's the enemy are producing cynicism and the predisposition to leave to those in power, to expert, to tell us who's the friend and who is the enemy. The character tends to accept the premise that anyone can be my enemy at any time. It is a condition of the national character that did not arise with the neoconservatives. It's there, it's part of the mainstream. It has to do with the economic structure, with the social structure. We are seeing the long-term results of political, strategic, and economic processes that have been brewing since the end of the Second World War, with the establishment of a wide and permanent security machinery, which threatens basic constitutional rights. When driven by a neoconservative point of perspective, the attack on civility and the attack on the juridical and political electoral system and procedure is stressed to a dangerous degree. The adoption, for example, of the preventive war doctrine, defined as war crime under Nuremberg, brings a strong dose of uncertainty, chaos, and anarchy to the political and economic relations of the world. It breaks the basic relationships of among states, established as an aspiration since the Westphalia Pact of Westphalia of 1648. This strategy is being put into practice since 9/11 with the excuse of a war against terrorism, together with a systematic attack on the constitutional machinery and the civil rights of the United States citizens. The actions of the national security state applied by Bush questions, according to the New York Times, 2 centuries of constitutional development. This can be read in a very interesting editorial of this newspaper dedicated to the trial of Zakaria Musaki, in which the district attorney arbitrarily suspended the rights given by the Sixth Amendment, denying the defense the access to fundamental evidence in this case. The issue is important because the district attorney's office tried to keep secret evidence about the links of Al-Qaeda with the machinery of the state. Some final thoughts, Mr. Chairman. The neoconservatives' profile, and not talking here necessarily only about the project for a new American century, but the whole cultural aspects involved in it, is highly militarized. The ideologists and members from the Bush cabinet give little attention to economic issues, show clumsiness in dealing with the political constitutional mess in the middle of which the regime is involved. Jimmy Petras has attracted attention to these deficiencies. He observed that the economical pillars to sustain the supremacy of the United States are not solid. He describes them as unstable and unsustainable. The first line lies in a sector which is highly vulnerable to speculation and volatility. The second one is the dependence of that supremacy in a high level of transferences, benefits, rate payments, royalties from the colonized areas. Using an index made by Pablo González Casanova about the transference of surpluses from the south to the north, that includes debt service losses due to exchange, flights of capital, unilateral transference, direct investment, net utilities, errors and omissions. I made an estimate with Omar Núñez about surplus transfers from Latin America to the United States and other creditors between 1976 and 1997 to show the degree of dependence on these transferences. We use figures from the IMF, the World Bank, and the Economic Commission of Latin America, published since 1982. Adding the total amounts separated by areas and their subsequent deflation using the implicit deflator of United States GNP based 190-90, we obtain a very, very conservative but very impressive figure of a transfer of $2 $51,619.1 million in surplus transferences. There are other estimates as well. The third pillar of the imperial supremacy, which is identified as the political power, which includes the power to print money to cover the deficit and the security that are offered to nationals and foreigners and people involved in illicit business. The modification observed in the structure of power of the international monetary system with the arrival of the euro as an option, currency reserve for central banks besides the dollar, and the dollar is a main feature of Pax Americana after the Second World War, make it a very striking contrast with the neoconservative discourse that appeals to an American supremacy, based almost exclusively on a huge conventional military power of the United States, as it was noted in the war of conquest against Iraq, in which the control of its large oil reserve has indeed played a key geostrategic and entrepreneurial motivation. And now, after a year, in the midst of what appears as the Vietnamization of Iraq, the resistance against the occupation is perhaps the greatest contradiction to this view of United States supremacy. And you have to remember that when the attack took place against the Saddam Hussein regime, it was the attack of a colossus with an economy 280 times bigger than that of Iraq, and with a military machinery with a strength three times bigger than that of Iraq. The aggressive unilateralism of military and also commercial policy practiced by Bush along this crusade against international law have put him, according to several surveys made in Europe, as a threat to world peace, and some of the opinions was a bigger threat than Saddam Hussein. It is the supremacy of a rogue state, of a rogue superpower. This was expressed by The Guardian in this way. The United States, the indispensable nation, begins to resemble the ultimate rogue state. Instead of leading the community of nations, Bush's America seems increasingly intent on confronting it. Instead of a shining city on a hill, comes a devastatingly different, divisive, and nationalistic jingle. We do what we want for ourselves. And if you don't like it, well, tough. Thank you.
Thank you, John Sachs. Perhaps I make a small correction in your text, or no, in your talk. The United States had a three times bigger military force, but in your text it is 300 times.
300 times.
Thank you.